from the twisted realm of science and the darkest pits of reason comes chilling tales of godlessness. Bear witness to the unfathomable terror that is the Good Atheist.
Welcome to the Good Atheist Podcast. My name is Jacob Fortan. Today I have a special guest. He's from the Pathos blog, Camel with Hammers, and he's come on the show now because we're going to talk about, well, a variety of subjects. Most of it is going to be a self-analyzing critique of the atheism scene in general. We're going to take a look at it. We're going to look under all the cracks and nooks and crannies. We're going to criticize the shit out of it. And my host, Dan Finke, thanks for joining me.
Thank you, Jake.
Ah, no problem. Well, the reason you're on the show, actually, is because of an article that we're going to be talking heavily about, which was titled No Hate. And I think it's important to just, you know, when I read that article and I posted a comment on it, you were just like, hey, man, I want to come on the show and talk about it. Because I think that you saw from just the article itself, which I want you to explain, where the discussion went, how it started to form, and in a sense, how you may have felt like that everything just keeps getting out of hand when you're just trying to deal with this issue. So first off, what is that article about, in a nutshell, if you could explain it?
The article, you know, arose out of controversy in the atheist community. Right now, within the atheist community, there's a tremendous amount of infighting, and it's centered around issues of misogyny. There's women online have been getting an extraordinary amount of abuse, not just in atheist forums, but all over the internet for a long time. And about a year ago, over a year ago, now July of 2011, there was a controversy with Rebecca Watson. She's a popular blogger who complained about being hit on in an elevator at a kind of time of night, you know, 4 a.m., where she didn't feel safe. And, you know, and it was very abrupt. Someone didn't know her. She'd already said she was going to bed for the night. So this caused a huge stir in the atheist community. And so I'm very sympathetic to Rebecca. I'm very sympathetic to the people who want to combat the misogyny in the movement. But my concern is that both sides of the issue have gotten very acrimonious in the sense of personal vendettas and disparaging people, labeling. And so my attitude is that there's just a breakdown of any ability to kind of reason across lines. I'm not saying that there's willing partners on both sides. The only way this will ever stop is if both sides stop pointing fingers and start having discussions. And the only way for me to get into that is to make this point that really, if we need to look at this in terms of if we're going to make a moral stand, we have to be extra scrupulous that we don't become self-righteous the way that religious people always have been. And that's this kind of introspection that I want people to have and not think that we have the right to call other people names and denigrate them and get really abusive and bullying with them, no matter what side we're on any issue. Like, this is not rationalism. It's an attempt to domineer with a will rather than with reason. And if we really believe in reason so much, then we shouldn't be justifying this tactic of constantly abusing one another.
I honestly believe that our scene, in a sense, the community at large, is a little bit, will always be much more sensitive towards the issues that are just kind of popping up. Because as we talked about, misogyny as a general thing is a kind of societal-wide issue that's popping up. I mean, look in the U.S. with the repression of women's rights on their own bodies. It's pretty fucking obvious that there is a pushback. And I think that in a way, I don't know if we really fully understand that those kinds of movements, those kinds of pushes, no one is immune from those forces. You know what I mean? Like, to suddenly feel that this won't somehow affect other areas as well is kind of silly and foolish. And I think that we just have this idea that we're an insular group. When there's, I mean, are we even a group, right?
Right. Right, exactly.
And I think that because of that in itself, we find ourselves in a weird position of deciding, how do we handle the situation? And I know that typically, I did a podcast the other day. I don't know if you heard of it on group polarization. No? I mentioned group polarization because I said, here's the atheism movement's popularity, in a sense, is based on this idea that groups of people who come together will reach more extreme or cautious positions than they would have normally thought otherwise by themselves. This is what groups do. So if you're a group of, say, liberal-minded people and you get together, then your beliefs are going to be pushed more towards that end of the spectrum where you might have still been kind of on the fence, right? Now, right. That has huge advantages. I think everybody can admit that, in a sense, polarizing isn't always something you're like, this is bad. We recognize that if we hadn't kind of polarized ourselves from this strong religious world that we inhabit, that I don't think we'd be who we are today, in a sense, if it wasn't for that force. But I think that that's where it kind of bites us back in the ass now, suddenly, where we are used to polarizing. That's the attitude, and that's the language that we've been using at this stage. But I think what we have to realize now is that part of that language is the need for it is starting to disappear. And a new kind of language has to fucking take place. That's what I think. That's why when I read your article, I'm like, I agree. Because I know that whatever the tactics that people are engaging now are not working. They're making people upset. I think there was an article in Friendly Atheist saying, if you're feeling tired by all this, just take a break.
I think that's exactly right. And I think one of the problems is, one of the issues here is you talk about the polarizing, and that's exactly it. Like when you're around people you share this one thing with, then you're going to highlight that one thing and dwell on that one thing and grow in that one thing. And then if someone goes in the opposite direction and they're sharing this opposite feeling, then they're going to be polarizing in that opposite direction. And then what's going to happen is there's going to be clashes, and what there's going to be is dialectical tensions where you have one pole against another. And the goal here is theoretically to have some sort of interaction between the two poles and actually work out new syntheses. The problem I have is that both sides of the debate, and I hate saying both sides because that's...
It creates a false equivalency, kind of.
Yeah, I don't want to create a false equivalency. I do think that the forces of misogyny are far worse than the extreme reactions against it. So I don't mean to equivocate, but it does seem to me that there's that temptation to not want to be in dialogue at all, the temptation to kind of assert a willfulness and an us against them, where you won't have any kind of dialectical growth. There's not going to be discussions going on in which you take these two sides and help find what's in both sides. Even where you have discussions, what'll happen is there'll be an article and someone will make a point, and then there'll be another article against it saying, well, what about all these issues? And instead of having the article come back and say, oh, yeah, those are good issues, so let's point out that, of course, I understand your point. Instead, it's, you idiot. Of course I didn't mean that ludicrous position, and of course I meant the qualifications you say, instead of there ever being a spirit that the people on the other side can actually be part of dialogue partners in any way. And again, now on the misogynistic side of things, I mean, I do think there are a lot of people who are acerbic for acerbicness' sake, but this is also an outgrowth of the same thing, because the polarization for atheists is defiance of social pressure to conform, to be civil in ways that are unjust to be civil, right? So that, like, religious organizations and religious communities and religious hegemony has tried to make certain kinds of speech impermissible. Criticism of religion, impermissible. Challenging certain kinds of moral ideas that are bound up in religion, impermissible. There's this tendency to assert the right to say anything as the right to blaspheme. And insofar as that's a legally threatened right, we need to fight for that. And we need to fight for the right, the legal right, to offend. And we need to be able to fight for the right to intellectually offend and morally offend when we have a moral argument or an intellectual argument that religious people are offended by, but we have arguments for. So we have a right to offend when we're making a moral argument, an intellectual argument, when we're using satire. And so I think the atheist community is so focused on the right to offend, you know, it's so focused on the right to blaspheme, because for centuries, that's the primary right we've been fighting for as atheists.
We're still fighting for that in many parts of the world. Like, let's not pretend that this fight is over. I mean, in Canada, it is illegal what I'm doing.
Exactly. Know? Well,
it is a fucking crime to blaspheme. I'm not shitting you. What I do is a crime. Because what I do is fucking blasphemous on a constant basis. My very book that I'm writing, Bible Stories, is possibly the greatest blasphemy that I'm ever going to fucking create in my life. Again, illegal in this country. I could get crazy fined. Every single penny I make out of this book, the government could take it away from me for having the balls to fucking say it. So the fight's not over.
Exactly right. Trust me, yeah. And especially the people living in third world countries that are dominated by Islam or oppressive forms of Hindu. You have serious issues here. It's a moral necessity that we have the right to offend when people are being offended on unjust grounds. So I get it. Why atheism is so bound up with that defiant spirit is because we're written out. Just being an atheist, just advocating atheist ideas is considered sacrilegious, is considered blasphemy or heresy or something. And so as a result of that, no matter what we say, we're branded that way. And so there's a consciousness where you kind of own that, where we have to do things like Blasphemy Day. You know, we have to do that. And I'm all in favor of that. I'm all in favor of saying no and asserting our right to speak, asserting our right to satirize, to make moral criticisms and intellectual criticisms. So I'm all for that. But the problem is that there's a temptation to then have an ethos in which there's nothing we can say that is genuinely wrong or genuinely offensive. And I think that's one of the things going on here. Some of the people advocating against the feminists are trying to say, look, we're against any kind of constraint on speech whatsoever. We're against any kind of moral strictures. We're against any kind of positive values that are going to hem us in. So they think that if they can just use as abusive speech as possible, they're like liberators of language, working against this oppression on language and rules about language. And then on the other side, what you have is there's a culture of saying, well, we're the right ones. The religious are just irrational. Everyone's just irrational. Actually, on both sides, this attitude prevails. You know, the religious are just irrational. And therefore, now when we have a new opponent, they're just irrational. So both sides just throw the word irrational at each other and just say, oh, we're the true skeptics. Now, look, when we're fighting against the religious, yes, you have people who explicitly are against reason. They explicitly will say it's just faith, or Luther calling reason a whore. So you've got on the religious side like a fear of reason, a suspicion of reason, an attempt to bring in irrationalism explicitly to one degree or another. But when we're not dealing in that context, just waving away the other side as enemies of reason and the good is no longer so easily justified. And just assuming that whatever you say that's abusive to somebody else is just an extension of your right to blaspheme and not a moral issue. It's just an extension of your being right and the powers that be trying to silence you in your holy justice. That's arrogant and obnoxious, and it's turning into a kind of self-righteousness that is corrosive. There's no self-reflection that maybe we could actually be wrong, or maybe the way we have to win this has to be within rules of civility and fairness and reason and community building consensus. All of that attitude is just shooed away as some sort of compromise, some sort of cowering to unjust rules, as though we're being forced to say we can ever blaspheme.
I think another way to illustrate that idea, I think I've said it before, is just because you might be morally correct doesn't mean that your actions are actually morally correct. And you can't automatically assume that they are. One of the weird things that I think that people have a difficult time wrapping their heads around is the fact that sometimes dealing with issues may seem counterproductive or counterintuitive. Like, how am I supposed to deal with someone who is constantly trying to send a lot of hate? Well, responding with hate is the first rule of what not to do.
Yeah.
Generally speaking, because what you're setting up the situation of justifying their own feelings of persecution or their own feelings of being attacked. Nobody really reads what they write. They don't understand what it is that is coming out of their mouths. They probably assume it's entirely different because they're facing with the mountain of their own prejudices and their own delusion. So you're attacking the truthful side of themselves that they don't want to see. So you're going to have a really fucking hard time breaking through that wall. And I think that everybody has to realize that, A, we all have stupid-ass moments with what I call SAMs. All right? These moments happen. And that I don't think it's necessary for us to suddenly label individuals who have stupid-ass moments. And realize that the way to get that consensus is not to isolate or insulate yourself. It's to actually, all of those people, the people that say homophobic things or the people that say sexist things, you have to keep them in your circle. You have to talk to them, because if you don't and you separate yourself from them, they'll only become more fundamentalist about their own beliefs. And that's the thing we have to fight.
That's exactly it. I have a friend who is sort of a private student of mine that I've been meeting with for about a year and a half, or 2 years actually now, who I met through the internet, and I've been teaching him. And he comes from an immigrant community, and he has a lot of patriarchal ideas. And from the beginning, he's been open to growing, But it's taken a couple of years of conversation after conversation to soften certain prejudices he's had. And it's gotten to the point, though, where 2 years ago I was making arguments to him about a pro-feminist argument saying, look, you've got to understand this. I mean, you have a daughter, right? You want her to grow up with X or Y or Z? And now it's to the point where 2 years later, when I'm pushing him on something and he's uncomfortable, he goes, oh, I get it, Dan. I mean, I have a daughter. I mean, he's using my own word, and like he's very slowly, but very surely on point by point becoming more liberal because of this long, patient discussion. And if you don't want to have these discussions with people from opposite viewpoints, that's exactly it. They're going to become extreme within the other viewpoint. And if people are not open to fail, if we punish people for being wrong, and if we make people feel terrorized, and I can't tell you how many people have talked to me and said, I want to write about things related to the feminism stuff and pro-feminist people. And they say, I just can't.
No, I get those messages all the time. I have discussions with people, and there are others who want to join in on these discussions, but they're like, I can't afford to because I'm going to, you know, my name is going to be dragged in the mud from just opening my mouth. And I don't want that to happen. And I mean, I don't think that people really realize that in itself, I mean, like I said before, simply holding the morally correct view does not make one's actions moral. Like, that's a really fucking important lesson that I think it's, even when you're trying to just instill it in otherwise rational people, it just doesn't sink in. And the issue at hand that we have is, you know, when we sling the mud and say that the other side is irrational, we're all irrational. That's the problem.
Yeah. And what's happening is, I mean, the thing is that I think in these debates, people respond not just to the things you're saying, they respond to your will. If your will is domineering, then they're going to interpret, why would I ever want to give you power? If your will is domineering, they're going to think the worst implications of your ideas. They might say, well, that sounds good, but I don't trust you. So I don't trust that, like, on these other things that I have to reason out, I'm not going to assume that the rest of your viewpoint is rational when you're bullying me around and pushing me. And so I'm going to assume that, well, maybe the extreme interpretation of what you're saying is what you really think, because you come off like an extreme person when you're domineering at somebody. And really, like, I think that there's probably two reactions. There are probably some people who are bullied and they respond to a show of domineering force. And so those people might actually be persuaded. But then the other people are going to just escalate. The other people are going to respond to your forceful will with counter-hatred. They're going to respond to your attempt to be Batman and vigilante and try and impose this order on them and, you know, vigilante for justice. And they're going to, like, respond to that by trying to be the Joker, trying to show you up and trying to counter and say, no, we defiantly won't accept you just because you're so obnoxious. And I just feel like it just exacerbates the problem. And even the people you win over by being so domineering, well, what have you done? Have you actually created a rational person? Have you helped someone actually think clearly? Or have you just perpetuated this whole process where the only way people change minds is by bullying and irrationalism, just like faith?
Right. Well, it's in case everyone's wondering, by the way, with the constant references to ethos, will, power, and that kind of stuff, it's quite obvious that you're a big fan of Nietzsche, or Nietzsche, depending on how you like to pronounce that last thing. I want to talk about his influence in terms of eroding your own faith, because I think that story a bit illustrates what I think we're trying to talk about. So let's go step in my time machine, and we shall go back to a time where you were at a college that's very, you know, right-leaning, and you were an evangelical Christian, and you stumble upon this philosopher. Tell me a little bit about what his influence is and why is he so important to you?
When I was in college, I had spent a couple of years studying the history of Christianity, and I kind of knew some of the reasons to suspect the authenticity of the Bible, et cetera. And I'd studied a lot of philosophy and had a lot of, you know, I had an increasingly suspicious view about the ability to have knowledge and the ability to have any kind of robust metaphysics. So I was becoming very skeptical. But at the time, it was under the influence of a religious sort of skepticism, which turned the limits of knowledge into an excuse for believing whatever we want, you know, a leap of faith with religion. And so I was trying to defend that kind of an irrationalistic view of the faith, where reason just breaks, reason just fails, so we need to have a leap of faith, and so we might as well leap to Christianity because look how internally coherent it is, etc. And in this kind of a mode, my best friend came out to me as gay, And he was also dealing with this kind of radical skepticism as a Christian. But in his case, he was dealing with a very deep nihilism that was connected to his belief that there was no truth, there was no value. And this was very much under the influence of Nietzsche. Some people, when they read Nietzsche, get this very dark interpretation of things. And he's also clinically depressed, it turns out. And he was dealing with homosexuality coming from a very religious mindset. And so he had this deep torment and this deep struggle, deep self-loathing. And yet he would also own it because, oddly, because his homosexuality was so repressed and he saw it as such a sin, he was actually also seeing, like, that was part of the rush of his sexuality, was the forbiddenness of it. Part of the rush was that it was evil. And so he was in this kind of very, he was in this very confused and dark place where this very profound desire of his was something he thought was utterly evil. And he was dealing with these tremendous doubts which were shaking the foundations of his faith. And he really would just push my faith. I mean, he was really on his way to atheism at the time. And he became suicidal even. And I was the only one at the time who knew that he was gay. So I was the only one who knew the reason he was suicidal. I was the only one, like, they found a suicide note that his roommate had come in, and my friend John was sharing his roommate's computer, went to use the internet and closed a document. As it was closing, he read, "Dear Mom and Dad, by the time you read this, I will have taken my own life."
So just in a fraction of a second before it closes, he sees that one line, right?
And he never reads the rest of it where he reveals that he's gay. So then they came to me that night because they didn't know who else to talk to, and John was not there. He was away. And so they came to me and they were like, "We don't know what's going on, but we think you might." So I went to him and I was very angry with him, which is not the way to respond to your suicidal friend. But I just felt so much, how could you want to take your own life? Because what he told me was in his letter, he'd actually written out the pros and cons of living or dying. And I was just like, how could you treat this as such an abstract, objective exercise that you're just going to, he said he'd written out these reasons and was going to sit on it and come back to it. And I was just so appalled by it. And I said to him, "Look, John, I mean, even if I didn't believe, I would still love life. I would still be committed to what I'm committed to." Or I'd said this before, but this was the same ethos that day, was I was saying to him, I can't imagine, even if I wasn't a believer, going to that length, wanting to kill myself. So there was this very dark cloud where Nietzsche was this threatening figure. And I needed existentially to go deal with him, because there was something about him where not only was he making arguments that were destroying my friend's faith, but it was going even further to where it was threatening his very life.
Talk about an impetus to read a book.
Yeah, that's an impetus to read a book. And so I think, like, that next semester there were other things that pushed me to him. You know, one day at the philosophy club meeting, I was a real, I was the president of the philosophy club. And it was a little bit of a cult of personality with it. I, you know, where a lot of people were big fans of me and my friends, because we were, like, you know, kind of hot shots and very outgoing and charismatic about philosophy.
Were you the dude from The Tao of Steve? Was that you? Like, the popular guy with just sort of, like, awesome machismo about him?
I don't know if I had machismo, but I had a lot of enthusiasm. I have one groupie, one woman who did have a crush on me based on that. And I know, because then she, the next year, dated the next philosophy president. So, but anyway.
Oh my God, she was a philosophy chaser? Crazy.
Yeah. He turned her down, though. So there was something of that. But anyway, so here we are, these hotshot philosophy students running the club. And this guy came in, and he was an economics major, not at all a philosopher. And he suggested that we read, or we were, I don't know if he suggested or we just read it on our own, but we were reading the first chapter of Beyond Good and Evil, or the introduction to The Prejudice of Philosophers. And it was so embarrassing because I felt like he beat us. You know, this guy who wasn't even a philosophy major, just came in, made the arguments for Nietzsche, and the rest of us just, you know, I just felt like we were sophists. I mean, we beat him technically, where in that we knew how to
use rhetoric.
We used arguments that sounded better, but at the end, I felt like we just lost. How did that happen? And I watched The Matrix that year, and it blew my mind. It was 1999. It was brand new. No one ever seen anything like it in a theater. And again, I took it as a very Nietzschean film. And so I read him. I read, you know, 600 pages in 10 days, or 640 pages, however long the portable Nietzsche is. I read it in 10 days, and it just devastated me, because here was this alternate perspective of the universe. It was so profound, and it was so defiantly non-Christian, and it had so much contempt for the Christian view that it created in me a gestalt shift. Like, I could just see the world differently for once, you know? It wasn't just that I could see some arguments that were against Christianity. It was the first time that I could feel the world from another perspective that wasn't Christian. And I'll admit, Nietzsche's kind of bullying dominant personality, and this is ironic, but that is its way, you know, is that he was so domineering and he was so certain of it that it did unglue me a bit from sort of, you know, all the certain domineering religious influences I had had. But what he called me to was my own skepticism. He called me to go deeper in the skepticism I already had. And one of the things that was most profound for me and most important for me was that when my friend was contemplating suicide, just the week before, I had threatened to disown him for religious reasons. And that's something I will always be deeply ashamed of, because what had happened was he had told me about his homosexuality in March of our sophomore year. And then in October, by September or October, he was getting more comfortable with it and started to talk to me more about it. But I was the only one he could talk to. And when he talked to me and I was supportive and, you know, I never abandoned him. I was always a friend and I heard him out. I was trying to support him. We both thought it was sinful. I was shocked when he first told me. I was so naive at 19. But I was real supportive and loving and understanding. And I didn't hate him or anything, but what I realized was he was starting to really share everything. So, like, he would literally go into detail about his fantasies. He would share, like, these desires, and he would kind of express to me that he thought it was sinful, but he didn't want to change. And I just started to get this bad vibe as a Christian that, well, maybe I'm making him comfortable, and that's bad, right? Maybe I'm making it where he doesn't want to change, and that would be bad.
Maybe I'm accepting him.
I was trying to be accepting. This is why I don't believe religious people can do this loving the sin, hate the sinner bullshit, because this is the position you're in. You know, if you're really going to love your gay friends, then you're not going to judge them. You're going to show up at their wedding and not grimace. You're going to be delighted for them. And if you're not delighted for your friend at their wedding, how do you love them? And so the position I was in was, the rubber was meeting the road. I mean, listening to him and supporting him, if it was going to mean encouraging him in his sin, I was like, maybe I need to expel the evil brother. I'd alluded to that might be something that I had to do. And then we'd had a couple long debates about the belief in the existence of God. And I suggested, I got frustrated. I couldn't persuade him. And I suggested he leave my room, and he did. And then, that night he wrote the suicide note. And so that was in the background. And when I'm reading Nietzsche talking about the truth and being committed to the truth and about rejecting faith as self-deception and making it a matter of intellectual conscience, I came to realize that this was a matter of intellectual conscience. These beliefs that I didn't have adequate justification for led me to disown my friend at his darkest moment when he turned out to actually be suicidal. I couldn't go on believing things that were that potentially destructive that didn't have good reason. And as a matter of intellectual conscience, I had to finally just cut it and accept that there was no God, or at least it was not likely. And Christianity was, in all likelihood, false. And that's why I've always been extraordinarily passionate about gay rights after that. Just been so concerned to kind of stop that poison by which well-meaning people, conscientious, dutiful, religious people who really believe they're serving the good, serving God, wind up doing such horrible, abusive things to people they love. It's heinous.
I remember reading in an article you had mentioned that the character of Zarathustra was particularly compelling to you because he had this sort of contempt of the inability to really challenge one's own values, like completely, to really look deeply into yourself and say, do I believe things for the right reasons?
Yeah, Zarathustra making that argument?
Well, no, that was you making that argument.
Yeah, that's my making that argument, yeah. Wasn't sure if you had Zarathustra. Yeah, because Zarathustra's thing was, you know, the Nietzsche's character of Zarathustra, this version of Zarathustra that he appropriates from the historical one. Zarathustra's thing is to just highlight the various ways in which moralism is the source of so much immorality, so much cruelty, so much self-righteous, vindictive hatred. and the way that morality itself has been twisted for such evil purposes, which is why I get, again, it's why I get the criticisms of the civility stuff. I get what they're coming from, and that they're saying that, look, when civility has always favored the powerful and been a tool of oppression, civility can't be just the only intrinsic good. And I get that. So calling for incivility, again, it's like calling for blasphemy when the law is religious hegemony. Or you call for incivility when civility is a code word for the dominant power structure that's...
Yeah, it's a code word for shut the fuck up.
Yeah, and I get it. When that's what it is, I get that's why you're angry. You know, I guess that's why you're pushing back. But Nietzsche calling himself an immoralist as his way of saying morality is just a code word for... Morality is just an excuse people have to do the same violent things that they want to do that are immoral, but with a good conscience. And so Nietzsche attacks morality itself because he sees it as the most evil of all power structures. But the problem is, just talking about being an immoralist, that you're like against morality, man, you have to reclaim the word morality. You have to reclaim the word civility. You have to rehabilitate these concepts and fill them with better content rather than say that you're just against civility and you're against morality and you're against order. That's just, that is never going to get the masses on your side. And it's not true, because you do believe in norms and you do believe in an order and you do believe in a rational way to do things. And so defend those things, but also live by them.
Well, you know, I think also you should be aware that the process of really having your mind changed begins, I think, like this. One, someone pushes you towards a particular extreme. Let's say in Nietzsche's case, where his willpower forces you to really fundamentally challenge this previous assumption you had so that it's utterly destroyed. But, I mean, we have to move beyond these thinkers. We move beyond Nietzsche when we realize that, hey, there's more to life than what you're talking about. And you know, that whole we stand on shoulders of giants. He said that shit long ago. Perhaps there's some other thoughts that have happened since then.
That's the thing. Like, I didn't just stay, you know, under Nietzsche's spell. Like, I worked through his view because it meant a lot to me and I wanted to understand it. But I always knew that there were things in there I would never accept. I would never accept his contempt for the weak. I would never accept all that stuff. He says a lot of nasty, horrible things, and I'm not going to like blanketly approve of it all. But I wanted to understand it. I wanted to get what was valuable in there. I felt like he was willing to push boundaries. I wanted to know. I wanted to think as out of the box as I could. And then when I built up a constructive vision of what morality is and what ethics is, it's built on having gone through the Nietzschean paradigm first. It's something more profound now for me, I think. It's much more where I really know why I think this. I'm not just trying to protect something. I was willing to go out on a total limb and believe nothing for a while and, you know, and try and doubt everything and try and adopt any viewpoint, even Nietzsche's harsher ones, just so I could see them through and see why there was good or bad reason. But then you got to grow out of it. And that's the thing. To me, the atheist movement has to move out of being the no-sayers. Nietzsche talks about it in terms of the lion that says no to the dragon of thou shalt. The spirit has to go from being a camel, which is obedient and takes burdens and wants to punish itself and be self-sacrificing, sort of like the best picture of a Christian moralist, like the most heroic version of it. That sort of camel, which is what I named my blog for, has to then, when it's committed to the truth, it takes heart, goes through the muddy waters of truth, it's committed for this higher goal, and then it has to become a lion that says no to the dragon of thou shalt, no to the idea that morality is fixed and permanent and not evolving, and that new values can't be created for better human flourishing. We have to move beyond that and say no to the dragon of thou shalt as lions. And that's where the atheist movement is. That's where Nietzsche was. That's where I was for a long time as I was writing my dissertation. But then the next stage Nietzsche talks about is going beyond the no-saying of the lion to become a child. And the child says yes. The child isn't saying no anymore. The child is no longer defined by who he says no to, but who she create, what she creates and what she does in the future, right? And so instead of being the lion always only saying no, only defining ourselves by what we're not, we create new values, new institutions, not in reference to what we're not, but with the innocence, the open-ended possibility. And many atheists are stuck in the lion stage. And I get that. It's an important stage. And I go through it. I go back to it every now and then. But you've got to have this sort of willingness to kind of think constructively. And part of that is social justice. I mean, that's why it's great. I think that the atheist movement, I think that that's why I like Atheism Plus. That's why I like the atheists who are trying to say, we're going to build new values. We're going to reject Christianity root and branch, not just the false, not just the obvious God stuff, but all the patriarchy and all that bullshit, all the homophobia. Like, we're going to create new values, and that's fantastic. But the other part of that that I think is missing is that we need to have an introspection about ourselves, and we need to recognize that we are not immune to the vices of fundamentalism. We are not immune to the vices of tribalism. We're not immune to all the nasty stuff that religious people are and have been. Like, we can become that even in defending our better new values. So unless we have a personal ethic in which we really are scrupulous and willing to hold ourselves to high standards, even if it costs us in a particular battle. I mean, one of the things people keep saying to me is, okay, but if the good people restrain themselves according to the rules, sometimes they'll lose an argument, or sometimes they won't be able to win. And my point is, well, that's what being a good person means having to deal with sometimes. Sometimes we're going to have to lose because it's a matter of principle not to become the enemy. And that's Nietzsche's line, right? He who fights monsters must be careful lest they thereby become a monster. We're fighting the monster of religion. We need to be careful lest we become one.
It's true. I mean, I think to a certain degree, this is where you approve of it. I disapprove of it, not because I disapprove of say, its aims. I only disapprove of it because I see it as, at least within the movement, creating polarization that makes this the sort of discussion that's necessary from occurring well. Like, I think it's not a lubricant. I think what ends up happening is that it just creates an insulated environment, pushes other people to a side, and in a sense helps to create labels by becoming a label itself. So in a sense, I think that we still have to kind of stay with our whole we reject labels for now, because I don't even know if we can still, if we're adult enough yet to deal with even a singular label. Because as soon as we sort of attach one, I see only, well, not only the worst, but I just see the increased polarization. And then on the other side, everyone else tired and not able to sort of like dictate their full position, because they may not know, but they certainly don't like the kinds of the behaviors that people are engaged in. And I think that makes them less interested in participating in the conversation. I think that learning how to deal with being a group that's not a group is our greatest challenge. But I think we can overcome that. I just don't think it requires us finding new labels, because of just, I think that when you create this thesis, you instantly create this antithesis.
Yeah, I mean, I think that is a problem. I think one of the problems, though, is that one of the issues is that I think we need to get, I mean, personally, I think we need to get past this idea that atheists can never have a shared viewpoint. Because one of the problems to me is that atheism is a philosophical position. Either it's the position that we shouldn't believe things that we don't have proper evidence for, so therefore we default to atheism, or some of us atheists really do want to say there is no God, like, or at least there's no personal God, there's no Abrahamic God, no superstitious interventionist deities. Then we want to say there really are none. And to me, that does have implications. I do think that leads to a naturalistic worldview. I think that is an implication of atheism. I do think within naturalistic ethics, there are arguments we can make that are about truth and not just our feelings. And that means that atheism would mean deriving whatever true ethical beliefs there are, those would go with being an atheist. And it would be distinct from what religious would believe. So I'm not one of these people who say there can be no atheistic philosophy. I do recognize you can't assign to any particular atheist that they agree with other atheists, that they must accept all the conclusions that might come true, that might be true. But I think when I'm arguing about ethics to other atheists, I think I'm arguing what all atheists should think. I don't think it's just idiosyncratic and personal. And I do think there can be such a thing as an atheist philosophy. But the problem is that in the movement, the atheists who wanted to say we stand with all these very good feminist values, or we're for social justice, etc., there were atheists who were saying you can't do that under the banner of atheism, because if you start doing that, you're speaking for us atheists who don't agree with you. Essentially, I feel like the atheism plus was a matter of those atheists who were being told, no, atheism's just a lack of beliefs. You can't say that your positive beliefs stand for us, or that they're somehow an outgrowth of atheism. Well, the atheism plus people said, fine, we're not you, we're atheism plus. And then they said, now you're being divisive. So I feel like they were caught between a rock and a hard place. Either they were going to say atheism should mean these things and argue for that philosophy. But when they did that, they were being told, you're trying to impose on all atheists that they have to have your values. And so their other solution was, okay, we're going to splinter off And now they're saying, you're trying to impose on us that we're not real atheists if you're not part of Atheism Plus. So I like the Atheism Plus. That the first week, that might have sounded what Atheism Plus was. Jen McCrite's first formulation may have sounded like she's trying to take over atheism. But not after that. Her clarifications that second week said, look, we're just a segment. We're not the whole movement. We're trying to carve out a safe space. And I think that interpretation of Atheism Plus is a great idea, in that these people were being told, get out of the movement or stop trying to bring in these other values. So now they said, look, we're not just atheism, we're Atheism Plus. So you have to have it has to be one or the other. Either we're going to have either going to admit we're going to have a discussion about these values, and you're not going to bully out people, but with all this misogynistic language and all these accusations of all these terrible things against Watson. Either you're going to do that, either you're going to have the discussion with the feminists, and you know, even if you're not one of them. Or you can't then complain that the feminists have set off for their own island.
I think that part of the problem people have with it is a bit of that irony of the word atheist in and of itself. Like, it is the first label in a way that people who had previously identified themselves in a very different set of labels have come to just sort of accept and sort of take. And there's lots of personal feelings that are mixed up in this, because despite every single time we try to define it as not a belief in God, we know that because of the pressures of other beliefs that they have on us, in a way we have to formulate our own kind of terminology that works for us. I think the problem actually is just the word atheism that's in there. It could have been secularism plus, in a sense, and I don't think you would have had as much of a kind of like bite at it or something like that. You know, not to say that that's the proper name for it, but just because, in a way, it doesn't evoke the same feeling in people. And sure, that word now has meaning that's distinct of that definition. That's why often in dictionaries, definitions have, like, wildly different properties, right? Including the word faith, by the way, which has two different fucking and competing definitions. But I think that we might be finding ourselves that with atheism, where, in a sense, maybe some people are like, just leave that word be, because I think that some people, at least, and this is a legitimate feeling, have this idea that if it becomes a representative in the eyes of people outside the community who cannot make those distinctions, and maybe they don't want that representation. And I think that that's still a fair call.
What about the plus? I mean, doesn't the plus make it a different word?
It makes a different word for us. It certainly doesn't make it a different word for anyone outside the scene who has no real understanding of those kinds of that kind of minutia.
Okay, but I mean, if you're saying that we're atheism plus and you're defining specifically that it's plus these other things.
Yeah, but where are you defining this, right? Are you defining this in a form of other believers, or are you defining this in a form of other atheists? How we, you know, how we present ourselves even generally out there, it still has to be, in a large sense, a kind of ecumenical degree. Like, we just can't have, as a movement, willy-nilly, that name be taken over by anybody. If I decide to call myself Atheism Minus, and I was doing all kinds of crazy shit, I think that people would be like, get that word atheism the fuck out of there, regardless of what the values actually were. I think it's just, but you understand what I'm saying, though, right? It's just sort of like, yeah, I think that many of us may know how it's defined. I think that even some people in the atheism scene have no idea what Atheism Plus means anyways. But that's, again, a little bit of a part of the problem. And you were saying before, well, some people will say, we don't want feminism introduced, and so, say, a feminist segment decides, okay, we're going to do Atheism Plus. I actually think that the people who said, we don't think that feminism should be part of it, are the ones that are wrong. I think that it should be part of it, but I don't think that adding that plus has value for people outside of the scene in terms of how it's perceived. Because so far, I just don't think that people are really comfortable with representation taken as a whole.
Right, but I think you're saying now two things. On the one hand, you're saying you want the feminism to be part of it.
Sure.
But if we do that, then that segment that doesn't want the feminism to be part of it is going to say exactly what you just said against Atheism Plus. They're going to say, how did you now co-opt us?
Right, but they're saying this in which context, though? Because if a person decides that they want any other element of a particular, I don't know, ideology, I don't know if I want to call that, to be introduced in atheism, it's not as though anybody's going to perceive that this is taking it over. I think that this is just sort of like an overreaction from a certain group of people. They're like, introducing feminist issue means that the atheism scene is taken over. And that leads to sort of like that, the reaction of saying, well, fine, we'll splinter. And I'm saying that that's the wrong response, because, again, what I was saying before is that people need to be part of the conversation. the individuals that are saying this is being taken over need to be brought onto that side of saying, of realizing that these issues are just the general issues of society that we also have to deal with. We can't just ignore them. We can't just say this isn't part of the conversation. Everything is part of the conversation, because when you say that God isn't the one that dictates shit and that we are, then we have to deal with everything.
My point, yeah, completely. But the problem is that there exist libertarian atheists, there exist liberal atheists, and that split is not going to go away. And I don't think that even the conversation happening, this was just happening where they were not willing to say, okay, we're both atheists, let's reason it out. I mean, ideally, yeah, maybe if the atheist community had this long debate for decades, maybe we would come to an agreement. I guess let me ask you this. One of the things that I actually don't want is a monolithic atheism anyway. And the reason for that is because, well, monolithic institutions are disasters. So there is something to saying, like for example, even when I think about, like, there should be atheist replacements for religion in the sense of communities and rituals and group parenting projects, stuff like that, where, like, people feel like there are other people who share their values they can talk to about parenting, about how to have practices like meditation and stuff without the woo. And one of the things about that is that I've always thought, even though I have very particular views about ethics and very, very specific views about a lot of things, I always thought it would be cool if the atheists had several types of groups for different people who didn't share my values down to the T. So maybe we'd not just, like, just looking at existing philosophical schools, there are existentialist atheists who might have a different kind of atheist community than Stoic ones or humanist ones. And there might be differences that are worth celebrating and letting us splinter off. And so maybe what we kind of need to emphasize that we're not a monolith is actually many atheisms. And you know, if you have atheism plus, well, you know, we already know about objectivism. Everyone understands that's a form of, you know, I mean, Ayn Rand's objectivism. Everyone knows that's an atheist worldview. So there's objectivism, there's atheism plus, and I think there's humanism. So I think that if we have the multiplication of them, I don't think that then there would be the fear that, oh no, you're speaking for us.
You didn't deal with that first issue that I had, which was the nomenclature issue, because in every other examples, none of those had the word atheism in there. Did they? And this is why I suggest that I like your idea of splinter groups. In fact, I want to start my own called the Butterfly Group. Yeah. Yeah, I want to start that. Because, you know, you go through a chrysalis period and you come out completely different. And that's what atheism, I feel, it is. And plus, I'm like, just because it's a butterfly doesn't mean it can't kick ass.
Right? Oh, right. Now, the danger of the splintering, though, is then then what happens to all this good conversation? And, you know, because then the danger is then we become hardened, right? So any one of these has to become non-dogmatic, has to be principledly non-dogmatic. And that's where, like, I'm concerned that there be an emphasis on self-formation, not like I think any atheism, to be genuinely an atheism and not become not set up a new god, has to make its rule that nothing can ever be sacrosanct in the way that, like, we can never reinvestigate rationally. Every belief has to be reinvestigated. Every tradition within atheism has to be one in which the founders, or there should almost be, I was thinking this morning, there should almost be a ritual in any atheist group where once a year, at least once a year, they have a day in which the leader is
Dude, you were in the midst of you saying it, I was thinking it.
Yeah.
Just to tell you how good of a fucking idea. It's like the Romans when they used to have that slave turns to master day.
They did?
Yeah, you never heard of that?
Oh.
Yeah, depending on the administration, whether or not it was actually enforced. But yeah, they had a day where you'd have a role reversal, absolutely. And it was like a big lark, too. It was a fucking, everybody was having fun on that day.
It shouldn't be, oh no, can I criticize this most powerful, you know, these powerful players in the atheist movement. It should be a matter of, at least on one day or several, that it's an obligation.
Yeah, it's a roast. We need to roast ourselves. And I think that the problem we have will always be the self-criticism. Right. It's just, where's it coming from? Is it coming from ourselves? Well, let me tell you something. Not always the best place. But I dig this idea of saying, okay, here's what we do. We create different little groups, and they're not really splinters. They're just sort of like, hey, if you specialize in one thing, because, I mean, we're getting to a size now where it's just like, hey, maybe there are groups that get together for various fucking reasons. Who knows, right?
Right.
And then all of a sudden you just say, well, every once in a while, everybody gets together and it's time for a big, everybody roasts themselves. Or like you said, you know, a tradition of once a year where you have to challenge and reassess your own opinions and say, like, you know, prove that you're right. At least once a year, go back and say, like, is this proof correct?
Yeah. And one of the things about this, because here's the challenge. The challenge is we can't live in perpetual state of uncertainty and dialectic, right? Like, and I think that it's unfair to ask feminists to constantly, for example, but all of us, to constantly live in a state of doubt, you know, and not be able to say, look, we believe in these certain values. We've thought about them. We've fought very hard for them. You know, we've bled for them in some cases. We have we've had to come through extraordinary personal struggle to identify as feminists or like as women or whatever somebody is that was difficult to deal with because of this fucked up culture which puts so much animosity on them. So look, you know, gay people deserve the right to live as gay people without defending themselves and have positive institutions and friends and family where it's never they're never having to justify themselves. And feminists need to be able to have discourse communities where they don't have to go back to square one against the patriarchy every day, where they can express themselves and think according to their own values and go in new directions. So I think that we all have to have that. No matter what we think, we have to have some safe spaces where we can get with together with other people who share our values and beliefs and move forward and not just be debating the outsider. My only concern, so that's why, again, these not splinter groups, but multiple subgroups within atheism are a good thing because they allow people to get further in those conversations of values and not constantly be at the front door arguing over which way we should go. But then the key, though, is once you're part of that group, being able to deal with the other group in ways which are introspective and reasonable and diplomatic and not self-righteous and hateful. And that lack of interest that atheists have to be absolutely scrupulous about not being hateful. I don't see atheists arguing about how we have to be so careful not to be hateful. Everyone just keeps assuming that because we don't have religion, we're just going to be perfect or, you know, great and accept those misogynists or something or accept those FTB bullies or something. It's nonsense. We have to be scrupulous and we have to be introspective. And we have to work on this.
Yeah, I think that you said it before when you were just I think it's pretty much the epitome of every single conversation everybody's ever had on Facebook is that if you're just trying to still be the good person, you have to accept the fact that you may have to walk away.
Yeah.
From a discussion and it you know, you're not going to have the last word because in a sense that is what trolling is. Trying to have the last word when you realize that maybe the differences that separate you from there aren't going to be bridged by this one fucking discussion.
And that's it. And I got to tell you, like, I have been attacked on the internet now that I'm, on the internet and visible. Like, and, you know, the biggest blog posts against me, I think I've replied once, and it was only because it was about philosophy and Jerry Coyne. Almost all the times I've been majorly attacked, I've had my character attacked, or I've had my views mischaracterized, and I almost always just walk away from it rather than escalate it, especially if someone wants me to get personal. If someone wants me to get personal, my attitude is, how is this going to help? How is it going to help to turn this abstract issue into a personal feud? That's not going to clarify anything. Not being able to let an issue go and not being able to ever accept that maybe someone out there will be deceived. Okay, you know what? It's better to accept that. You know, Nietzsche has a great line. Zarathustra says, you know, he said, you know, where he says, you know, people are at their worst when they've been wrong. That when someone wrongs you, you should commit 5 little wrongs immediately so that you're not alone in your being the oppressed, right? And so the idea is that, you know, he says that a wrong shared is half right. He says a little revenge is more human than no revenge. And so, you know, so a punishment should be a right and honor for the transgressor. So the idea here he's saying is to not become so self-righteous, you know, not to use the occasion when you've been wrong to just kind of stew in your wrongness, but to kind of but it would even be better, rather than commit a great wrongness against them too, to have little wrongnesses so that you can avoid feeling so self-righteous. Now, I don't think we should actually do the 5 little wrongs and share the wrongening. But I think that ethos of actually recommending that as a spirit of charity, that you don't try and make the other person feel like the devil, that they're totally inferior and evil, but that instead you try and restore the balance in some way. that the emphasis there is on that, is on finding a way to bring the other person so that they're not going to be the demonized and the evil one.
And you have to remember too that process, like you mentioned before, with that student, it takes a while. I know my own father for a long time, held some fairly racist views, and then I think that, over the years those just eroded. But I think the final straw was really when he met a man who was in every way his equal and just happened to sort of like have a different pigmentation. They were the fastest friends I'd ever seen in my life. And I think that was sort of the end of it. And you mentioned just before that the way that other guy changed his mind was through exercises of empathy. This is exactly why you cannot reject people from that fold. You realize that there is the one trick to get them will always be empathy. If you're right, you just need to make them feel the way that you do, and then they'll see the world the way you do.
Exactly. And in fact, on that point, when you talk about empathy, like I have never in my life met a straight person who said, I used to be against gay rights, but then one night I met a gay person and they called me a breeder. And I felt so bad about myself, and I realized, oh, maybe that's how gay people feel. It's never the story. The story is that people came out, and they realized that people they loved were gay, and people that they cared about were gay, or they hurt gay people, like in my case, with my friend. And realizing that there were gay people all around and that they weren't monsters. They were great people and normal people, and all they wanted was the same thing anyone else wants. And once you put it in those terms, there's been so much progress. Now, again, I get it where you needed to have a stone wall. You needed to have a night where when gays were completely being marginalized and abused and police brutality and violence against them, that they did need a moment of fighting. They did need that. And I get it. And like I'm never going to blame the gay movement for that moment. Can't blame the gay rights movement for that when the AIDS crisis was going on and people were dying left and right, that you had to have an ACT UP campaign which got in people's faces and said, this is a dire human rights, life and death emergency. If it's that severe, I get it, that there are times when you have to be more aggressive and less about the long haul persuading people with empathy. But insofar as it's possible to at all reach out with empathy, reach out with understanding. And one of the things that I read an article once which said, if you're in a group, the way to be the person with new ideas, innovative ideas, who wants to change the way things are done, is to first establish yourself as sharing common values with everyone. If you're someone who they already identify with as on their team and sharing values, then when you have new ideas, they're willing to hear them. If the first thing they hear from you is new ideas that uproot everything and overthrow everything, they like mark you as an other. They mark you as a threat to the whole order, not just a bad part of it, the whole thing. Mark you as the immoralist, the opponent of the whole system. And so what you need to do is be able to make the connection with people and say, okay, well, we disagree about these things, but let's talk about what we do agree about. Have discussions about where the common ground is and build rapport with people. And if you can do that, then they're willing to listen to you as someone with a shared ground.
Yeah, and you said before, and I think this is an important part that I want to just reiterate, is that we can't make the people who are wrong make them feel like they're demons, for being wrong. Being wrong is just a normal thing that's just going to happen. And if being right is just so right, it should be fairly easy to kind of give people the benefit of the doubt. If they're in the wrong, maybe there's a reason for that. Maybe there's a way that they haven't seen your perspective properly. And just remember, I know it sounds ironic coming from the good atheist, because I practically made a career out of just talking shit about people. But, and this is an important thing that I want to mention, is that when it comes to the scene itself, our scene, this is a precious little fucking infant that needs to, not be thrown out or just smashed against the wall. I'm attacking institutions that have long track records of abuse and terror, and I'm fighting that shit. But when it comes to us internally, I think we realize that the hammer is not the way to fucking deal with a situation. No offense to the title of your blog.
The thing is, on this theme, Rwanda, that heinous genocide they went through, the way that they were able to kind of create a workable country after that is to say, look, we're not going to like we just have to admit we've actually murdered each other. They just focused on people confessing everything and then being forgiven. And as heinous and, I mean, genocide, you know? And the attitude was, if we don't have honesty and we don't have people genuinely admit what they did, then people are always going to be hating that. If we do not let go, we will never be able to get along. And it will be just more bloodshed in the future. I think one of the things that's secretly in this that no one's getting at because of the level of discourse we're on is that what feminists are challenging, very rightly, are norms and beliefs and habits that are rooted in a lot of our dating practices. So what that means, a lot of our family interactions, a lot of people's relationships with their spouses, their lovers, their boyfriends, girlfriends. And in that context, a lot of times when feminists are saying something is harmful, for a lot of men to accept what that means is to accept that maybe one night they did something really wrong. And their interpretation of it, if they're going to accept the feminist view of things, is going to have to understand that maybe they're going to have to see themselves as a sexual harasser when they didn't want to see themselves that way, you know? And it wasn't what they meant. Then they have to go, oh, whoa, was I a sexual harasser? Or did I push that woman too far? Does that make me a date rapist? Those things are going to be going through men's heads when women make, you know, and not just women, but men. When we make these arguments for feminism, what you're going to start implicating is people's own consciences. And you're going to give them a fear that if they accept this worldview, then they're a horrible person. So how do we soften that blow so that they're willing to own that and not feel like they have to go hate themselves or make them feel like they can actually reconcile? Because part of the cognitive dissonance might be their own guilt if they actually accept this viewpoint. And so that barrier might be in there with who knows how many men.
Right. Well, I think you said it before, right, in Rwanda, where it was necessary for people to just have that, the forgiveness was more important to the long-term well-being of everyone than just immediate justice. And even that maybe that justice was going to be impossible anyway. It's just a fucking archaic concept that doesn't really have real-world applications most of the fucking time.
Justice matters in that you can't have people get away with it forever. You know, you can't just keep forgiving. And this is one of the other problems, right, is that abusive religions have taught women that they have to keep forgiving their abusers, you know, and not just the religions have taught this. And so you have Jesus not even allowing divorce for spousal abuse, you know, only adultery. And so you do have women who are pushing back against, they're saying, look, these narratives of forgiveness, women have been forgiving. We're fucking tired of that. And so we have to find somewhere in the middle here. We have to find somewhere where there's a kind of forgiveness, there's a kind of confession that affirms the dignity of the victim, but also doesn't reinitiate that cycle of abuse. And yet on the other hand, you're not going to win over men who fear that what they believe were consensual sex is going to be called date rape on a new definition, or what their normal way of flirting is somehow going to be considered equivalent to rape or something like that. That's what they're really worried about. They're having an existential psych out, and we've got to figure out how do you calm them down that they're not going to be demonized for bad socialization and really fucked up decisions.
Well, I think that one of the first things that everybody has to realize is that these issues are going to take time, but I think that we may not be seeing the improvements because we want them all to happen instantaneously. That's our desire, right? We want that world to exist now. And what we don't realize, though, is that the even the parts that we wrestle with ourselves, you know, like that's all part of that work that needs to be done. That's the scary thing now. We live in a world where we have begun to challenge all of those assumptions that we had, all of those structures of society that were previously built on these systems that we all admit were garbage. And now, you know, it is a scary process moving forward. The only thing that I hate in that process is watching people who feel, like I said before, that, and we've talked about, where they feel like the weight of this, of the anger and frustration they feel justifies the direction that things have started to take. And I'm like, it does not. Right. I mean, like, we have to remember to be the bigger people when we try to fight for justice and right, that there will be opportunities where we lose. But in the end, This is a fucking long-ass protracted war, people. It doesn't just happen with this one battle. It's just a long-term thing. And I think that at the end, we just realize that the solution to all of this, just like the title of your article, is no hate.
Exactly, yeah. And it's to remember, you know, Marcus Aurelius says, look, you know, when you wake up in the morning, I'm not going to get this exact, but he says, basically, when I wake up in the morning, I tell myself that the people I deal with are going to be rude, they're going to be selfish, they're going to be obnoxious, they're going to be self-centered, they're going to be hypocritical, you know, they're going to be vain, they're going to be harmful, you know. And what I have to say to myself is, this is who they are, and I have to learn to work with them for the, you know, because we are made as 2 feet to walk together, you know. We have to work together. And so we have to look at each other, not as evil, not as monsters, not as irredeemable, but as people who mean to do the good, who think they're right, and who need to be reasoned with to be corrected. Like Aurelius also says, who wants to do what he really thinks is bad for himself? Or, you know, nobody really thinks that they're evil, except, you know, very rare people, maybe sociopaths would get, but they don't even understand evil, the sociopaths and the psychopaths. Everyone with a conscience recognizes that they don't want to be evil. And so everyone sees themselves as essentially good, trying to do the good. Or if they don't, they feel really bad about that. And so people mean to do the good. So it's a problem of knowledge. It's that they're ignorant. They don't see it. They're trying, they're emotional. And if we stop getting so sucked in by that, that we hate them and treat them like they're monsters out to get us, and instead if we sympathize with them and say, okay, I get it, you're just another person like me trying to do right, now let's try and reason and find common ground.
Mm-hmm. And I think that, again, like if we will know that we break, the first person to break the rule of civility, at least in our eyes, should be the ones who lose. Now, where that discussion goes, maybe, like we said before, maybe some of these you just got to step the fuck down, you know?
Yep.
And that's probably how it's going to be. Well, Dan, thanks for coming on the show and talking about all these issues. I hope everybody doesn't feel like it was too heady, but definitely was great to have you on. And I think by the end of this, we can all sort of like come to this agreement that we're a community of discussion. And that's just kind of like we want to make sure that discussion is going to be pleasant to have. And I'm like, that's the end of my preaching.
That it should be constructive and in a spirit of goodwill. That's all. I mean, it's going to be unpleasant, but some of these things are hard. They're going to be emotional, but at least a spirit of goodwill and reason.
Well, you said it better than I could. Thanks for coming on the show, Dan.
Thank you, Jake. I really appreciate it.
No problem. Have a good Atheist Day, everybody.